Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Did you know that students get it free? The Irish Times offers a free digital subscription to all full-time undergraduates. Keep up to date for free with quality journalism and reporting. Claim yours today at irishtimes.com/subscribe/student.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. Today, we are talking to Alice Ryan about her first novel, a sprawling family saga full of warmth, humour and oodles of character set in Dublin, London and Bali. It's called There's Been a Little Incident, but getting published for the first time wasn't totally straightforward.
So, I didn't hear anything back. And on the Curtis Brown website, it said, if you haven't heard anything for 90 days, you can email us. So my husband and I got the calendar and we put 90 days on because I'm a very conscientious person. And on the 90th day, I sent one of these like very female emails that was like, I'm so sorry. Just if you don't like it, maybe I might send it to someone else. And immediately they wrote back saying, we never got it. There's something wrong with the server. Send it now. Halfway through reading it, her assistant said, we love it. Stop. Don't send it to anyone else.
That was Alice Ryan there and more from her a little bit later. Before that, a couple of things we wanted to bring to your attention. On Saturday, the annual ARC March for Choice is taking place in Dublin. And why do we still need a March for Choice after we repealed the 8th in 2018? Well, because unfortunately, there are still restrictions on abortion provision in this country, which means that some women are still having to travel. And of course, we're now in the final stages of the abortion review, so it's all to play for. And if you want to join in the action and stand together for equitable, accessible and legal abortion for all, the march begins at the Dáil at 12:45 p.m. this Saturday. I also just wanted to mark the horrible situation in Tehran, where a 22-year-old Iranian woman died after being arrested for violating strict hijab rules, a protest against the Islamic Republic's morality police. Mahsa Amini was detained on the 16th of September for allegedly wearing a hijab headscarf in a, quotes, improper way. Activists said the woman, whose Kurdish first name is Gina, has suffered a fatal blow to the head, a claim denied by officials who have announced an investigation. Police continue to maintain that she died of natural causes, but her family suspect that she was subjected to beating and torture. She died in the hospital last Friday after being in a coma for 3 days. Her death, as you will probably have seen, has sparked widespread demonstrations in Tehran and Kurdistan. Iran has shut off the internet in parts of Tehran and Kurdistan and blocked access to platforms such as Instagram and WhatsApp in an attempt to curb a growing protest movement that has relied on social media to document dissent. The protests are going on at the moment and they've spilled into cyberspace with videos of women burning their hijabs going viral. Other women have been posting emotional videos in which they cut their hair in protest under the hashtag Mahsa Amini. So we wanted to mention that terrible news today and just send solidarity to all of those protesting. Now, I wanted to begin my interview with debut novelist Alice Ryan by quoting from a piece she wrote recently about her mother, Caroline Walsh, who was former literary editor of the Irish Times, a wonderful woman, someone I knew for a long time and a much missed colleague of ours here in the paper. And Caroline Walsh died by suicide 11 years ago. Alice wrote in this piece, "When my mum died, I wished she'd been hit by a bus. I wished she'd been killed instantly in a way that didn't threaten to rewrite her life. Of course, everyone's life gets rewritten. When they die, they become nicer or funnier. But suicide doesn't leave much room for anything else. Shadows appear over every story and cast doubt on every happy ending. which is hard to fathom because during my mum's lifetime, if there was one thing we were guaranteed, it was a good story and without fail, a happy ending. There's Been a Little Incident is Alice's first novel. It's a story of a lost soul called Molly Black and her Dublin family, a story about the people who have your back when things get really tough. Alice and I had a wonderful chat about her mother, about writing, about grief and about family. And I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. I began by asking Alice about something she said recently, that writing her first book was an act of hope in the face of terrible loss.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, my mum died under very tragic circumstances, and I had actually been writing before then, but it did take on a different facet after her death. And I think after a while, you know, there's terrible sadness, but after a while, also, what's left is the happiness. And it was a really great exercise for me in recapturing that and kind of, you know, always say that the characters are definitely fictional, but the feelings aren't, and the emotions. And I wanted to write a novel about grief that was ultimately hopeful and that was warm and that left you feeling, hopefully, that, you know, it was better the time you had, and that the ending didn't kind of sour it totally.
Yeah. And you wrote an incredible piece in the Sunday Times recently, which moved me a lot because I knew Caroline and I worked with Caroline and she was just a wonderful woman. Tell me a bit about the circumstances of her dying, just so people know. Like you said, it's very tragic. It obviously was. It's 11 years ago. It was very, very shocking.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thanks for saying that about the piece, because genuinely it was harder for me to write that piece than the novel. I know that sounds ridiculous, but you know, to get our head around how she died is still impossible. It's still very hard. Sometimes I wake up and think, did that really happen? So my mum was a really happy, wonderful, kind of fun person. She brought great imagination to everything. She was really interested in everything. And that's why she was, you know, she had a great career in the Irish Times for 36 years, because she genuinely was. You could have sent her to cover the schoolboys GAA on a Tuesday and she'd have just come home and said, I mean, the pageantry, you wouldn't believe it, you know. So she was a very happy person. And she got a very rare illness. It was related to her thyroid, and it was thyroid-induced psychosis. And I'm always conscious to tell people, like, this is really rare, because I know a lot of people have issues with their thyroid. I don't want everyone, you know, getting worried. It's really, really rare. And it took quite a while for us to even understand what was going on. But in 2011, in the September of 2011, we began to notice that she was really quite unwell. The symptoms at first were physical. So she had an ear infection that she could not get rid of. She couldn't shift. And after antibiotics, it was determined that actually her thyroid was making her unable to, it was kind of making her immunity lower. And then unfortunately, the psychosis began to set in. So she had terrible insomnia. She lost a huge amount of weight. She had a hand tremor. And she really detached from herself and from the world around her, which is very hard to believe, you know, because she was such a person of the world. She was in various hospitals. I think she was in six different hospitals. And the problem was, you know, with a condition like this, it's a physical, you know, there's a psychiatric manifestation of a physical issue. So she was in physical hospitals and they were saying, you know, we'll treat the thyroid. And then she was in psychiatric institutions and they were saying this is a physical element. And it was a bit of an, you know, I was going to say it's a bit of a nightmare. It was a full nightmare. I don't know why I added the bit. It was your worst nightmare to see someone you love lose their mind. And very, very sadly, on the 21st of December, when she'd been bounced around from hospital to hospital and she was going through these psychotic episodes, she took her own life. And it was at Dunlier Pier. And I was the first person to arrive on the scene. And, you know, there was a moment actually, Roisin, where I kind of thought, you know, they found a pulse. And I thought, oh, okay, this is, we've now realized how serious this is. And that's our lesson. And Christ, I'm going to become the world expert on thyroid, on psychosis. But it wasn't to be. And, you know, we were left absolutely floored. I don't need to tell anyone listening because you can imagine. But we, obviously learnt more about the condition, and with time, and that's why this piece, it was so important for me to write this piece. With time, we were able to kind of say that her death was one thing and her life was another.
Yeah. And you write in the piece that there was times when you wished that your mum had died by being hit by a bus or some kind of accident like that, which is in fact what happens to the mother in your novel. But you also were talking to someone about psychosis and they described it to you like the person is on fire all the time and you're just glad that she wasn't on fire anymore. But for a while you wished that she had obviously died in a different way.
Oh, completely. Like, and I'm sure people feel that who don't have suicide, but even, you know, a long and difficult illness. I mean, there's definitely worse things than death, right? You know, and I think seeing her suffer like that and seeing her have to come to the place where she ended up taking her own life is just, that's way harder to live with for me than her death, you know.
And just, let's talk a little bit about Carolyn before we move on to the novel, because in that piece again, which is just superb and so moving, I've read it a few times now and it's just very, very affecting and gorgeously written because you're such a great writer. You started with this incredible anecdote about Carolyn, which I think captures her spirit. So tell us about that, about the day that she was on the tour bus.
Oh, and these are not embellished, Roisin.
I know.
Like, in fact, some of them I think I had to take down because, you know, people, you know, I had to take them down a tone. So my mom and I would go off into town. She was just great for an adventure. Like, I remember her bringing me to like a candle factory in Tullamore. You know, like she would bring me, we would go anywhere and it would end up being a fantastic day. So one day we were in town. And it was a horrible wet day and we were waiting for the bus. It was actually pre-Lewis times, so and pre-apps. So you'd be waiting for the bus, as you remember. Like, you'd have no idea, like, when it was coming. And we were waiting there and we were waiting. And she just said, look, that's it. The next bus that comes, I'm getting on. That's
whatever
it.
Bus it is, wherever
yeah,
it's going.
And you know, as a child, you have those moments when your parent slightly loses it, you're kind of like, part of you scared, also part of you is like, this is deadly. Like, what's going to happen now? So the bus comes around and I'm like, God, where are we going to end up now? The other side of the city. And it's the tour bus. And I knew immediately we weren't getting on because the tour bus was, I think it was like £10, you know, and our bus fare was maybe €1. And she didn't even look at me. She just stood right up on the step, got on, paid her money. And at the beginning, the tour bus is empty. The man is looking and he's like, oh, where are you guys from? And she's like, Ranelagh. And we go right up to the top. It's pouring rain. And he starts doing his tour. And at first, she just starts saying, she's just adding in little bits. And as you can imagine, by the end, she has the mic. She's telling these huge stories. I think maybe she was singing by the end. And I do remember when we eventually got home, we couldn't actually tell my dad what had happened because we were laughing so much. And I think, like, that imagination she brought to parenting was just, it's the greatest gift.
Yeah. And the other lovely moment that I really appreciated is that you'd be telling her some story or asking her for something or some more stationery that you needed for school or whatever else. And she'd get this look in her eyes where she'd just look at you and see you. Tell me about that, because it's actually, when I read it, I thought, I need to look at my kids more like that. But go on, tell me.
You know, to have a mum like that. And that's where, you know, people always say to me, oh God, your mum committed suicide, that's really tough. And on my bad days, I'm like, yeah, it was awful. But I'm also like, God, not everybody has what I had. And it used to really annoy me. I'd be saying something really important, like, as you say, the highlighters. Like, when you were 14, I mean, the highlighters are a serious deal. Like, if you don't have your pink, your red, you know. So I'd be saying something and I could just tell she'd zone out and she'd have this serene smile and she'd put her hand on my cheek and she always called me my darling girl. And I just think now that I have my own daughter, I love that she was able to take those moments and just enjoy me. And she'd kind of be smiling and then eventually she'd say, okay, grand, we'll go into Reeds again, you know. But she was in the moment, and I guess that's a great gift.
She was in the moment and she just appreciated you, and you knew that and you felt that all the time, which I think is the thing, isn't it?
It's exceptional. It's exceptional. Yeah. So I'm obviously, look, I wouldn't want you to think, you know, that I'm okay. I'm absolutely not. Like, there's several therapists around Dublin and, you know, lots of medication later, you know, and it absolutely is a very difficult thing that I live with all my life. But that was why I wanted to write that piece, was to say it didn't negate all the goodness. And actually, you know, that's the only thing that remains in the end.
Well, I'd urge everyone to go and seek out that piece, because it is wonderful. And I'm sure it was difficult to write, but in another way, you've probably been writing it for a long time in your head.
Definitely. And, you know, I wanted to do it for her. I wanted to say to the world, this is who she was. This is her death, and it doesn't change anything.
Yeah. Well, listen, let's get to the novel, because there is a lot of grief and loss in it, but it's also a very, very funny book. And it's, I mean, I would say it's in the spirit of Marion Keyes. There's a big sprawling family. There's a lot of fun and crack and Irish humour. And then there's a lot of poignancy and grief and loss as well. And that's kind of, I suppose, what is the theme of it, about how when things fall apart, families can be the ones that put it back together again. So why did you want to explore that? Was it related to the fact that you'd had, I mean, it's called There's Been a Little Incident, which is kind of, you know, it's a small way of describing something quite big. But tell us about the motivation and the themes in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always obsessed with this idea that, you know, and it's happened to me so many times, you can be in a really bad place in your life, and it's very surprising where the support can come from. And it's sometimes it's someone in your family. It's often someone in your family maybe you didn't quite know too well. But it also can be, you know, a friend that you didn't know you were that close to. And I've had moments in my life and I cry less when bad things happen to me than when I do when good things happen, you know. And there have been several moments where people have just come out of the woodwork. And it's just such a hopeful thing when someone reaches out to you and kind of sees you're struggling. And I wanted to write a novel that was, a hopeful, warm novel. I'd actually written a first novel that ended up in the bin. And only my cousin had read it. And she said she loved it. It was great. And a few weeks later, she said, just can I ask, like, are all your friends, like, are they deeply unhappy? I was like, sorry? She was like, you know, like eating disorders and like, you know, and it was the novel you write in your 20s, you know, and it was everyone was a lot of angst. And I thought to myself, OK, it just really struck me because she said, like, you know, you're actually funny. But it was none of that in the novel. And I think, I don't know when people write what they think, but I definitely, for that first novel, thought, like, I want to be taken seriously and I want to do something that's really, you know, powerful. And I would sit in London and I would do things like, you know, clean the whole flat before I was ready to write the novel. And then, you know, that novel went in the bin, it didn't get picked up. And then I thought, okay, what if I just wrote the novel I wanted to write? And that novel was written almost entirely on my phone while the fish fingers were burning, or while I used to keep the soother in my daughter's mouth, like with one hand, and just write at 4 a.m. on the other.
I'm really surprised that's on your phone. But although there's a lot of text messages in the book as well, which really work brilliantly. But how did you find writing on your phone?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think I look back now and I do think it's very funny. When I was in London and I wanted to write, and I'm like, do I feel like writing today? And I look back now and I'm like, who is your one? Like, that's just not, you're never going to get a novel written like that. And for me, the phone was absolutely the main place. I still, you know, that's where ideas come to me on the bus, on the trip to creche. And I would write everything down, and then I take like a week's holiday from my day job and I like plow into it. And you know, sometimes I've gone and stayed with my dad in the countryside in the middle of nowhere and left my daughter with my husband and just worked all night, and he would just provide me with meals, and I just used the messages on the phone to build something.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I I was just thinking as you were speaking there, you were talking about your cousin. So, you know, I'm wondering about the pressure because your grandmother, Mary Lavin, absolutely revered Irish writer. Your cousin, Kathleen McMahon, who is another revered Irish writer. Now, your father, James, is a writer and also lectures in creative writing, I think. And obviously, Caroline was the literary editor of the Irish Times. No pressure, Alice.
Yes, gas, isn't it? yeah, no, do you know what? It's funny because I did the usual thing of when a child, you know, I grew up in this literary household and I'd say I didn't read a book till I was 17. Like, I just was like, I've no interest in this. And because they loved it so much and they desperately wanted me to write. So what used to happen was every evening I would pick a tome from their big bookshelf. And they had these really big ones. And I'd pick a really thick hardback one to paint my nails on. And I would, yeah, and I would take it. And then years later, my mum saw me do this and her face fell. And I was like, what's wrong? And she's like, for years, your father and I thought that secretly you were just very interested in the analytical take on Ulysses. But no, I'd just been painting my nails on them. And I always like the big ones, you know, for the thick. So, you know, I went off and I studied economics and I was like, I don't know about that writing business. And then it just, yeah, it kind of came out and I didn't tell any of them. So that's what you have to do in my family. You have to write novels secretly. So I didn't tell anybody until I had gotten the book deal.
Really?
Yeah, I actually changed my name as well. So my name is Alice Ryan, but I made up an email address with my husband's name. And that's how I sent the book out, just in case anybody would connect who my mom or my
dad
was.
Why was that important to do that, Alice?
I just didn't want anyone doing me any favours. And also I'd seen how it went. I was pretty sure I wasn't going to get published. Like I so many brilliant writers don't get published. So I just thought I don't want people. What I didn't want was people saying, when Alice is writing a book and how's it going, Alice? And then me to be like, oh, I got another rejection, Mary.
So you didn't get rejected. What happened? You sent it off and what was the...
Oh, Roisin, I got so rejected. Okay, yeah, I got worse than rejected.
Tell me all, lay it out.
Okay, I got so worse than rejected. I listened to your interview with Bonnie Garmus and I was really jealous of her rejections because what I got was radio silence. So I sat in London writing my big novel secretly thinking, oh my God, wait till everyone sees this. I sent it off to everyone and no one ever wrote back. Like, nobody. I mean, nothing. No one even confirmed that they'd gotten it. And do you know what? I was crestfallen. You can laugh about it now, but like, it doesn't make it any easier. So and then a few weeks, months later, I was sitting at my desk at the BBC and I got an email and it was from Sheila Crowley at Curtis Brown. And it said, look, this isn't the novel. It's not right for the following reasons, but you can write, go again and send it to me. So I swallowed the absolutely massive lump in my throat and I started again. And then when I sent it to her, I didn't send it to anyone else. It meant so much to me that A, she bothered to get back to me, and B, her feedback was spot on, that I was like, this is the person for me. And then she took me on.
So when you took her feedback and you rewrote essentially what you had sent her?
Nope. I started a whole new novel.
So this is novel 3.
This is novel 2, sorry.
Oh, no, this was the original one that you put, that is in the bin.
There was, yeah, I sent her the one that is now in the bin, yeah. And then I wrote a second one. It's really funny. It really distresses my brother that the first novel can't be resurrected. I'm like, no, it's like, it's not good enough. And he's like, but I'll be first handy now. Just take it out and, you know. He's like, can we not just, like, you know.
Polish it up there and
yeah,
make
a little bit.
Good.
And I'm like, no, my dad very kindly calls it my PhD.
Oh, that's lovely because it is a lot of work.
You know, I know, and like, to be honest, the second novel was 3 years, but only because of the first 10. And okay. I actually can hear myself sitting at home in London being like, you're some idiot saying that. Like, because the person in London was very annoyed and very low, and you know, and it's very hard to put a novel in the bin, so I shouldn't discount it. Yeah. But I'm very glad I started again.
So when you sent, there's been a little incident to Sheila Crowley then, did she say, this is it, this is the novel?
Okay, so this is how, I'm glad to tell you these stories because they are so awful. So I didn't hear anything back. And on the Curtis Brown website, it said, you can, if you haven't heard anything for 90 days, you can email us. So my husband and I got the calendar and we put 90 days on because I'm a very conscientious person. And on the 90th day, I sent one of these like very female emails that was like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Just if you don't like it, maybe I might send it to someone else. And immediately they wrote back saying, we never got it. There's something wrong with the server. Send it now. Halfway through reading it, her assistant said, we love it. Stop. Don't send it to anyone else. And then they took me on.
Well, that is a great story. But imagine if you hadn't sent the email.
But it just does show you need to have nerves of steel. Like, because so many times I was just like, to be honest, I don't think I have the nerve. Like, I don't know how these people do it. And I, you know, because I was in bits. Like, I remember wandering around Waterstones in London, like in Covent Garden, like kind of imagining that Macy Gray or someone was on in the background. Like, you know, just being like, this is it. I'm not good enough, you know.
Well, look, that's an incredible story, and the rejection. And it's, again, like you mentioned, Bonnie Garmuse, I think there's so many people who just keep going, the tenacity of it and not giving up. Brilliant. But tell us about the central character, Molly Black, and the Black family. It's a big sprawling cast of characters. I don't know. I mean, it starts off and you're kind of trying to remember who's who. And you do it amazingly because you do get to know these people and you keep you manage and navigate all that so well. So tell us about the Black family.
Oh, yeah. So Molly is one of those people, I think we all know them. We all maybe are have them inside us as well, where she kind of has just been off and she's been all over the world. She's been waitressing in Manhattan and she's been doing ski seasons. And I think she kind of turned around one day and realized that everyone else was settling down. So she gets to 29 and she's had this amazing youth, and then suddenly people are doing this insane thing called getting mortgages and they're having babies, and she's like, is this what we do? And I think it's then that her grief really from losing both her parents at a young age begins to catch up with her. And, you know, obviously we've spoken about grief, and what I wanted to capture was how like nebulous grief was and how not linear it is, because I think for me, like at different points in my life, I'd just be grand and I'd be going along with my business. And then other points, it would just hit me. And I think people maybe who haven't suffered from it get, you know, I certainly got a big fright because I was like, why now? And what's provoked this? So she's kind of having a bit of a crisis and she disappears. So then we have her very eccentric family back in Dublin in Leopardstown, who kind of meet together. And the thing is, like, she's 29. She's written a note. So what does one do? Like, you know, technically, you know, as far as the Gardaí are concerned, she's grand. But her amazing Uncle John is just not going to let her go. And he decides to rally a group to go and find her. And I guess the novel is what ends up happening.
Yeah, we don't want to do any spoilers, but I mean, it's a gripping read. There's a subplot as well involving another missing woman, which keeps you guessing too until the end. And how did you find that writing so many characters? Because that is, I think that's difficult for anybody, never mind your debut novel. What was your, did you do a Maeve Binchy and have it all on plotted out on the wall, or what was your strategy?
Well, I really wanted to have something that worked, but it just kept changing. So like I'd make an Excel spreadsheet, or I remember going into town and buying like, you know, big yellow posters, and then that would fall off. So it really was just in my head. And I think there's a great freedom in it being your debut novel and in already having been rejected. You know, a lot less mattered to me. Like I just wrote who I wanted to write. And I think in hindsight now, I think I understand that, you know, some people, you know, it's harder to get published, say, if you have a multi-strand narrative. But the truth is, they're the books I like to read. So I had nothing to lose this time. So I just wrote what I wanted to read. And I wanted to read about, you know, mixed up people who have, you know, bad things happen to them as well. And you mentioned Marion Keyes, and that's where she is a total genius, because she does this amazing mix of light and dark. And I'm always surprised when humorous novels don't have dark and dark novels don't have humor, because like, Christ, that's what life is a mix of both. So I very much wanted to write a novel that made you both laugh and cry.
Yeah, well, it does that completely. And just going back to your sort of, what would you say, writing pedigree, and it's kind of fascinating to me that you saw yourself in that vein, maybe in this serious writer vein. Not that you're not a serious writer, but you're obviously a very humorous person. You're funny and light. And once you embrace that side of yourself and that side of yourself as a writer, things clicked for you. So it was really about being Alice rather than being some other version of what you thought you might should be as a writer.
Oh yeah, you'd have to laugh. Someone said to me recently, they'd read the book and they took me aside and said, don't worry, it is a literary novel. And I was like, all right, okay. And then now it does straight, it is a bit popular at some points. And I was just like, oh, it was very funny. Because I do think people are obsessed, aren't they, with like what genre something is. And definitely more obsessed if it's a female writer. I think for me, like the idea that something is negative if it's popular is gas. And it's negative if it's commercial is also gas. But the truth is, you know, a lot of the writers I love now, a lot of them were American and they had straddled this. I'm thinking particularly of, say, Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
Yeah.
By Maria Semple.
Brilliant.
And yeah, How to Kill Your Family by Bella Mackey.
Oh, I love that book. I had her on as well. Fantastic.
Yeah, and for me, it's like that. I was like, okay, hang on. There is a genre here and it's dark and it's plot driven, but it's also kind of does have that in depth and it can be funny. So I think it's not something that has been done that much in Irish novels. But like, say, Maeve Binchy's a great example. Like, you know, there's scenes in Maeve Binchy where you're like, hang on, Maeve, that got very dark. you know, and everyone thinks of Maeve as light. But I think in hindsight as well, everyone can see someone like Maeve's genius. And, you know, so I guess in answer to the question, I just began to not care. And look, it's as simple as everyone says that. And you only succeed when you begin to not care, isn't it?
Yeah, I do think it's interesting though, that someone felt they had to reassure you that it was literary. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think there's a long way to go before we, you know, when we realise popular fiction, anything that people want to read is just as valid. Like, why this obsession with so-called literary stuff?
Oh, I thought that was hilarious. And then also, you know, when you're talking with your publishers, they're like terrified. They're like, now it's crossover. And everyone's like, guys, it's crossover. Don't worry. It's crossover, you know, which I guess means literary and popular. And you're like, oh, it's crossover. Don't worry. Yeah. Like, it's book club
fiction. It is about this sprawling family. And I'm just wondering, when you started to show it to members of your own family, were they all looking for bits that were like them in it?
Oh, so my aunt rang me and she was so quiet. I was actually quite nervous. And she was like, I didn't recognize anyone. She was not impressed. And I was like, well, that's the point. Like, it's fiction. And then she was like, I'll have to read it again now. Because apparently she'd read the first time, she just read it, just looking literally for, yeah. So, you know, it's funny. People who know me definitely see a few things in there. Like, it's just more of me in there, I think, than anyone else.
Yeah. I mean, and going back to Caroline, because you wrote in that piece as well about how you went back to some of the books that she loved. And you talked about how you kind of went away from the reading up till you were 17 or 18, almost as a rebellion against it being pushed. I'm actually thinking of my own house here. They're not reading at the moment and I'm absolutely devastated. But I have to keep stopping myself from talking about it because, you know, it's probably because I went on about it so much that they're not. It's probably my fault. But anyway, you might give me some tips on that. But you did go back to the books your mum loved after she died.
Oh, look, it was the greatest gift. It was like a survival kit. And the amazing thing about my mom was she kept notes in all her books. And, you know, and obviously with suicide, it is, you know, you question everything. And I'll never forget one of the days I opened up Everyman by Philip Roth. And there was a quote about his daughter and how he didn't know how he'd made someone so amazing. And she'd taken it out and she'd written on the first page. And, you know, it's those things that, like, those gifts that, you know, it's like someone speaking to you from the beyond. And I did, I began to read, like, God, I was reading, like, you know, 30, 40 books a year. And I just got such solace from the knowledge that this is what she had done and that she had faced difficult times and that she had got through them by reading. And I loved, you know, there was sometimes where she would read, like, something, you know, and she'd write in it where she was on holidays and I could picture her. And yeah, it was a total gift for me. And I think I kind of fell off a cliff though after, because I was the luckiest person in the world when it came to book recommendations. You know, my mum was a literary editor. She literally would read every single book and then she'd be like, this is what she will like. And then I was like, guys, where do you get books? Like, what does one do? So I'm actually a huge Goodreads person. I love Goodreads and I always go on and kind of get my books that way.
Molly Black's mother and father, as you said, they both died when she was quite young and the grief kind of catches up with her. But there's some really beautiful letters through the book, which are from Molly Black's mum. That she wrote to her when she was a baby and wrote to her as she was a parent. Something I think a lot of us think we're going to do and then never get around to. And I just wondered, was that something Caroline had done, or where did you get that idea for doing that?
Do you know, that was not something from my mum. That was something I did for my daughter.
You're one of those good people that do that.
Well, no, I'll tell you why, Roisin. I'll tell you why, quite candidly. I really struggled after the birth of my daughter. I say candidly, Christ, who doesn't? I was so tired from the childbirth, and then I was in the hospital, and then they were like, yeah, no, Brian has to leave. I was like, sorry? What? And those first few days, and I just was like, but when will I sleep? And when will I, you know, and I got diagnosed with postnatal anxiety, and I just really, really struggled to kind of just catch up again. And I was so lucky, you know, in particular, and not everybody can say this, but like my brother was unbelievable. You know, when you lose your mom, like people are saying, you know, do you have a sister or someone, but my brother was exceptional. And he just talked about coming out of the woodwork. He just was there pretty much all the time. He made a rota of help to get people to come and mind the baby. And when I began, I got a little red diary. And for me, that was, I didn't know yet if I was going to be a good mom. In fact, at the time, I thought it was pretty awful. But I thought, I can write down something, and I can write to her, and I can start to tell her what I'm thinking, and also maybe say, like, I am struggling, and maybe if you become a mom, you'll remember that. And then I was very, very lucky to meet with the psychiatrist in Holles Street, and he was amazing. And he said, look, everybody's a good mom at different points. So like for some people, the newborn is, they just love it. And he was like, you know, you're probably going to find that once you pass the newborn, you're just amazing. And I just looked at him and I was like, okay, Dr. Farrell, okay. But I hung on to that. And, you know, I especially once my daughter turned about one, like, Christ, we have the crack. Like she said to me last week, we were on holidays in Kerry, and I said, look, I'm having a lovely time. Thanks so much for coming with me. And she didn't say anything. And I said, look, but to be honest, like, it's actually my holiday. So thank you for coming with me. I think motherhood was something you could grow into. And now I just adore it and I'm all about it. But keeping that diary was a way for me to kind of get to that place. So, and there's definitely stuff in the book that is ripped from the diary for sure.
Yeah, well, that's some of my favourite bits in it. I just love it. And again, as I said, I'm just jealous. I had great ambitions to do that when I was in the early stages of parenting, but I didn't do it. But I suppose I was writing a column, so there's probably bits in there. I must look back and find them.
And as you can imagine, Roisin, I have the one diary and I was like, that's great now. And I get on to year two, one page on year two. So, you know,
okay, I feel better now.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. And also, once they start to speak, like, you have the relationship with them. You don't want to be like, hang on, hon, I don't want to talk to you. I'm just writing in the diary.
That's
which
right.
I actually think I remember doing.
I wanted to ask you, because you, I was very pleased a while back when I heard you got this really big job at the BBC, which had such a great title, the Head of Insight and Planning. And your job was to kind of think about what audiences would like, which is a huge thing. And I'm fascinated by it because, for example, one of the things you worked on was David Attenborough's Blue Planet, which was the highest rated consolidated TV programme of 2017 in the UK. So you're someone who's had to look at what audiences would like and have insights around that. Did you apply that when you were writing your novel? Did you kind of use that stuff?
That's such a good question. And I mean, Christ, I don't think I'll ever get over having worked in the BBC. Like every single day I went in, even though I was there for years, it never got old. Like it was a fantastic job. And I'm so lucky now to be, I've actually just started as head of insight at the Arts Council. So I'm able to stay in that area. But it's really funny because I'll tell you how it was really useful in that my job was to go and to, as you say, consolidate audience feedback and bring it to, like, I would go on the train to Cardiff and go to the writers of Doctor Who and say, you know, like, this isn't really working, this is. So where it was really helpful for me was when I was getting that feedback as a writer. And I remember, like, my agent being like, this is very unusual. Like, you're very excited about the feedback. And I was like, yeah, like, this is my bread and butter. Like, what a gift to have someone take the time. Look, it depends, you know, if you don't have the right person or they don't see what you're trying to do, that's really tough. But when they do try to see what you know, if they do understand what you're trying to do, I was so lucky, my agent, Sheila, and her assistant, Emily, like, I didn't really know that agents gave notes, but, like, Emily would write me these editorial notes. And I'd just be like, saying to my husband, she's right. And he'd be like, can we finish dinner? And I'd be like, no. Like, yeah, you're dead right. We need to do this. And so it was this huge gift. So absolutely, my day job has been incredibly helpful. And also, I just love having a day job, to be honest. Like, I kind of think I I can't imagine not heading off for the day and getting stuck into something.
So tell me about your writing life now. Are you writing the next one? What way is it going?
Oh, there isn't one, Roisin.
Sorry?
There isn't one. Like, I do have this chronic fear that there's someone at home, like I was after having a baby and like really struggling, and there's fish fingers everywhere. And they're like, you know the way Weedabix really sticks to everything? So it's like everywhere. And she's just sitting there going, oh yeah, Alice's mother killed herself. And then she had postnatal anxiety. But, you know, she just jumped up and wrote a novel. You know, I really hate that idea, you know, that kind of Instagram, like right now, there is absolutely no writing happening. I've got the day job, I've got the three-year-old, I've got the promotion for the first book. But I'm so excited about getting stuck into the next one.
Well, I love that answer. And I do hope everyone whose fish fingers are burning and have got Weedabix stuck everywhere feels a bit better after you've said that, because...
Roisin, everywhere. Like, everywhere. Like, I mean, seriously. And you're like, okay, you want Weedabix? Okay, okay, go, go, go.
And I suppose I just want to ask you, because I think, I mean, it must be something that all your family are saying, but Caroline would be so proud of you. So proud. Nobody would be prouder. How does that feel? There must be... that loss as well of knowing that your mum can't see what you're doing.
Do you know, I look at it a different way, which is she absolutely orchestrated the whole thing. You know, and as I say, because it was such an uphill battle, you know, again, to our aspiring writers out there, I think there was a lot of fluke. Like, there was a lot of, I don't feel like, okay, because this novel was so good, it got published. Like, I've read things before, and I'm sure you have, and you're looking around and you're asking everyone, this is so good, why wasn't this... You know, so I think I hold her totally responsible for all the good things in my life. And I don't know, I'm not a religious person. And before my mum died, I wasn't sure about heaven. But like, it factually must exist, because there's no way she would give up on watching us. And I could often hear her like laughing at different things. And, you know, and that's where her presence being so strong is great, because you actually know what she would say. You know?
Yeah, so I'm sorry, I just said Caroline can't see what you're doing, but there's a sense in you that she's seeing everything, and that not just that she sees it, there's been a guiding hand there as well.
Yeah, there's definitely been a few moments, like, and I do have such a black sense of humour, but like on the night that she died, and on the pier, Gardaí started to run towards me, and I was like, Mum, not now. But he was the most handsome person. I mean, he was Brad Pitt. It was Brad Pitt. And I was like, Mum, this is not going to make up for it. And I know that that's not to everybody's taste. But, you know, that. So I think, you know, and, you know, we were, Colm Tobin actually very kindly, you know, after Mum's death, a lot of writers wrote about Mum and, I guess, her legacy. And he did a great kindness to me, because, and to my brother, because he wrote, when he was asked to write about her, just about me and my brother and how much happiness we gave her. And again, you know, after suicide, everything's so uncertain, that was such a great gift. And he said that he met us one day when I was a child in town, and he said, what are you guys in town doing? And Mum said, I'm just enjoying my beautiful daughter's company. And to have that is to have all the luck in the world.
Well, that's a lovely way to finish, Alice. I'm so delighted for you. It's a brilliant, brilliant book. It's funny. It's moving. Yes, there's the laugh and the cry in it. It's clever. It's real and authentic. And it's just, your voice is very, very clear as a bell, you know, and congratulations on it. And I know I can't wait for the next one, which will come whenever, you know, whenever you get around to it, that's fine. Are you enjoying this part of it, talking about it and being out there with the book?
Do you know, I'm not like a shy person, but I have found it very daunting. Like, it's a lot. And as I say, struggling with the day job has been really tricky. So I'm looking forward to a bit of time. You know what? And you know this as well. Like, having kids is a great leveler. You know, because I'm kind of manic days. And then I go to creche at 4:30. And my daughter said to me, she said, your book is out now. So when you go into the bookshops, they'll just give it to you. And I don't know, I think she means like my book is in the book I'm getting as a present, you know. And she said to me, look, I feel bad for you because the books that you have, they're all the same. She thinks that, you know, she said, oh, you've got 5 of the same of the book. I was like, yeah, well, I only wrote the one, but they just gave me, you know. So she just like...
Yeah, you'll never get a big head when you have children, I think I found.
Why do you look so beautiful, yeah. Mom?
She said that when you just sort of had washed your face or something to wear a nice... dress for an interview.
Oh yeah, yeah. When I come down the stairs wearing anything but black leggings, why do you look so beautiful? Or if I do any cleaning around the house, who's coming over? Mortifying. More than
that. Brilliant. Well, it's been absolutely a pleasure talking to you, Alice, and hearing about Caroline as well, and just remembering what a wonderful woman she was. And I'm not surprised you've turned out to be the woman you are with a mother like that. You know, it's incredible. And the best of luck with everything. And hopefully you'll come back on when you have your next one.
I would be honoured. Thank you so much for having me.
That's it from me for now. Thanks so much to Alice Ryan, and her book, which is brilliant, is called There's Been a Little Incident, and it's in all good bookshops now. The podcast is produced by me, Roisin Ingle, and by Suzanne Brennan, with JJ Vernon on sound. Get in touch with us on social at IT Women's Podcast. We're on Twitter and Instagram too, or email us, thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. Mind yourselves, and I'll
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Talk to you next time.